Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. Additional support for The Pulse is provided by AstraZeneca and Independence Blue Cross.
Everything was everywhere. It looked like the whole world came down to New Orleans for Mardi Gras, and they didn't clean up afterwards.
10 years later, the emotional fallout from Hurricane Katrina continues. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
There is this myth that scientific progress is achieved by some sort of a direct march to the truth.
I think sometimes I meet scientists, and when they hear what I do, they're a little afraid.
They will eject their entire digestive tract, and then they will grow a brand new one.
Weird ideas are all over the place.
So the question is, why?
What are these people? What do we always so against?
We don't get for having a bigger brain.
Well, you'll probably hear the sound of a lot of rushing water dripping.
Who say zero?
On today's show, a new insight in the air conditioning wars and why women are really cold in the office, the forbidden treat one pediatrician wants to bring back, and gender reassignment surgeries. Who does them and who pays for them? But first up, it's been 10 years since Hurricane Katrina struck the Gulf Coast, and much of the physical damage the storm caused in the city of New Orleans has been repaired. Neighborhoods and communities have been rebuilt. Schools, hospitals, businesses, and restaurants have reopened. But a deeper, invisible wound brought by the storm remains. Thousands of residents, and especially children, were traumatized by the storm and the displacement and struggle that followed. Reporter Lane Kaplan-Levinson brings us this story of a young man for whom the storm unleashed a torrent of difficulties.
If only my bosses like my cooking as much as you two do.
In late August of 2005, Kendall Booker was in fifth grade watching cartoons. All of a sudden, the program blacked out and George Bush appeared on screen. Annoyed, Kendall flipped through the stations in search of another cartoon, but all he saw was the president.
My mind just snaps. Something really is going on, and it's serious to where this man is on like 50 channels. So I decided to listen, but at that time, I couldn't comprehend everything.
And the safety of their families first by moving to safe ground.
Hurricane Katrina is lashing the
Gulf. Soon after that, Kendall's grandfather came in the room and told him they were leaving. He was living with his grandpa at the time, and his siblings were all split up, staying with different family members. Kendall and his grandpa went to a Days Inn in Dallas, but he had no idea where his brothers and sisters were. On the hotel TVs, things did not look good back home.
Everybody's saying this is a direct hit. Like, I don't know what that was. Like, until I see so many people crying on the TV and like this channel that they had for so many lost children. And I'm just wondering, where my brothers or anything, my sister.
Of people trapped in buildings that have come down around them, they have
Kendall was only 9 years old, and his grandpa wasn't explaining when they were going back home. Most importantly, he wasn't explaining when Kendall could go back to school. He loved being in school.
It was so fun to learn at that time. Like I used to just mug the clock, like, it's 3 o'clock, you serious? Every Tuesday before Katrina, we used to get out for 11 o'clock. I hated them days.
Kendall hated those days because it meant he had to go home. He grew up with an abusive single mom who beat Kendall and his siblings. It got so bad that school and neighbors noticed and called Child Protective Services.
They came on a fire escape and they came through our window. I just see them grabbing my brother, taking him out the window. It's some white people. So I'm like, what the hell is going on?
This happened when he was 5. His mom went to jail, and he and his siblings were split up into different foster homes where the abuse continued.
I was just in the room all day. As soon as I come home from school, I just in the room all day like an inmate. She probably gave me a snack every once in a while, and I broke it down because I felt like I wasn't eating as much, so I saved it.
Kendall went from one foster home to another for 5 years until he finally moved in with his grandparents. This was shortly before Hurricane Katrina. Through all of this adversity, Kendall says he never had any behavioral problems, But when he evacuated to Texas, his grandpa kept making promises that he couldn't keep.
What I really was missing was school. Like, he keep telling me, I'm going to sign you off for school. Man, he never put me in school. That's one thing I'm thinking about. Well, my family, that's another thing I'm thinking about. Like, all that's building up inside of me. So, like, that's how I flashed out the first time.
By flashing out, Kendall means his first violent episode. He describes it like a blackout. Alone in the hotel room, Kendall started throwing rocks he had brought from outside against the wall and through windows. He ripped the blankets, he broke the TV, but he has no memory of doing any of it.
It was just a bunch of things damaged in my hotel room. Everything was all over. I don't even know how they got me to the mental hospital. I can't even remember.
This marked the beginning of Kendall's flashouts that landed him in and out of mental institutions and jail for the next decade. It's like losing his only pillar of stability, the classroom, ended up unleashing years of pent-up trauma. Kendall experienced another trauma when he returned to New Orleans and saw an unrecognizable place.
It's like a tsunami came. Like, everything was everywhere. It looked like the whole world came down to New Orleans for Mardi Gras, and they didn't clean up afterwards. Like, it was obvious the city was dead.
This is what thousands of children returned to when they came home. Mental health professionals scrambled to help them cope with the shock.
Hi, my name is Beth Cooney. I'm the director of evidence-based practice for Project Fleur-de-Lis.
Fleur-de-Lis is an organization that was started in the wake of Hurricane Katrina to deal with long-term impacts of trauma that children experienced related to the storm.
We have kids that were floating on doors in the Ninth Ward here. We hear their stories, and they were 4 or 5, and they remember it. You know, they'll have tons of experiences, but they'll say that's the one that bothers them the most.
Cooney specializes in trauma-focused cognitive behavior therapy. The organization partners with schools, and together they identify students who may benefit from the program.
What we do is basically a trauma screening. So the way I kind of describe this to teachers, you know, sometimes you need to get your ears checked or your eyes checked. We're coming to kind of check how you're doing based on your experiences.
In addition to living through Katrina, many of these kids have experienced a high number of adverse childhood events, which many mental health providers refer to as ACEs.
Most of our kids have experienced, you know, 4 and 5 ACEs, having a mentally ill person live in your home, having experienced child abuse, physical abuse. We teach kids how to understand the things that they're experiencing because of trauma, things like nightmares, trouble sleeping, and we normalize that and say, you know, because you've experienced this traumatic event, this is normal.
Cooney says most of these kids also have post-traumatic stress disorder, and they're in a state of hypervigilance all the time. So they play games to learn how to relax and calm themselves down. Fleur-de-Lis' strategy to access these kids through schools is something the city at large is starting to embrace. One of the goals is to make the city's schools trauma sensitive. Here's Charlotte Parent, Director of Health for the City of New Orleans.
Hopefully what happens is you begin to recognize when students are having issues, and instead of, you know, dealing with them in a way that is creating a bigger problem, and that this may be an acting out based on some sort of trauma versus the child is just a bad child.
This concept of asking what happened to you before judging behavior is just catching on with mental health providers around the country. And for a health department that usually focuses on issues like heart disease and diabetes, it means switching gears.
For us, what was identified by our community as the leading public health problem is violence. We can't address and arrest our way out of this and put people in jail. You have to reach down further and hopefully shift the paradigm from the parenting pieces all the way through.
Parent says it's impossible to ignore the impacts of Hurricane Katrina when looking at the city's current struggle with gun violence and high incarceration rates. The storm was 10 years ago, but it's a daily presence and always will be.
The effects of Katrina, you know, for a lot of us, whether it's children, adults, if you lived through it and you were here and experienced that, there's no way that that's going away. It is a death. So, you know, imagine if someone close to you passed away unexpectedly, and you were left to try to figure out what to do.
She says Kendall Hooker's story is a familiar one. Kendall is 20 now and just graduated high school in May. He's living what he calls post to post, sleeping on different friends' couches each night, looking for work, and trying to stay out of trouble. But he still often feels alone.
Honestly, you just really got to train yourself, because a counselor not going to be there when you're at that point of, like, really, like, flashing out. And I know the choices I make have consequences.
He has a 5-year plan. By 2020, he wants to be financially stable, he wants a place to live, and he wants children. But most importantly, he wants to feel safe.
I just want to be in a better life, to where I won't have to look back every time I step out, nothing like that. I want to really be comfortable with the life I live.
For The Pulse, I'm Lane Kaplan-Levinson.
Since Katrina, the country has, of course, experienced several other major natural disasters, for example, Hurricane Sandy. And joining us now to talk more about mental health in the wake of disasters is Sandro Galea. He is a physician and an epidemiologist at the Boston University School of Public Health. Sandro, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
How did Katrina change emergency mental health care, or maybe mental health care in response to trauma in general?
Katrina was a sentinel event in this country. I think it took us all by surprise at many social, political levels, and then also at the level of mental health and mental health treatment. This was a large-scale disaster affecting people from all walks of life, but particularly people who were already socioeconomically disadvantaged. I think as a result of Katrina, our systems of response are stronger. I think it pushed us to consider ways of outreach that we had not thought of before, and pushed us to think about reaching hard to get to populations and making sure that after a large-scale event, all populations who may need help can get help.
What kind of mental health services do people need in the more immediate aftermath of a disaster?
Most scholars who study this and most therapists think that what is most needed are supports, are ways to make sure that those who have lost their houses, lost possessions, lost loved ones, are supported through the acute period so that natural resilience, if it's going to be there, is going to set in. It's also important to keep monitoring people so that those who do have symptoms of mental illness and who continue to have them then get the treatment they need.
What are you learning about the long-term mental health effects? Are we talking mostly about trauma and post-traumatic stress, or what are some of the issues people do experience long-term?
Yeah, the sentinel mental illness after trauma is post-traumatic stress disorder. But one thing that's not well appreciated is that PTSD seldom happens by itself. Post-traumatic stress disorder, in the majority of cases, happens with some other mental illness, many times depression, but other times other mental illnesses. So the treatment for people who continue to have mental health consequences of these events is complex. It needs to take into account a full range of pathology. And in many cases, the full range of pathology is debilitating and disabling. So we have learned that certainly prevention of mental illness after large-scale traumatic events is probably the more effective way to go, which is why I circle back to this helping people return to normal life, supporting them materially, supporting them psychologically, so that they can resume their normal functioning, which is probably the most protective thing that we can do to help people not develop long-term mental illness to begin with.
Do you know any statistics in terms of what percentage of people develops a longer-term problem after a disaster?
The people who are most likely to develop long-term mental health problems after a disaster are those who were themselves injured in the traumatic event. So these are people who are really directly involved with the event. Those people, you can have up to 40%, 4 in 10 of them, going on to have long-term mental illness. Then you have a group of relatives of those people, or relatives of people who died, or people who are close to someone who was injured. And in that group, you can have about 15 to 20%. So it's about 1 in 5 to 1 in 7. You have uniform providers who are also a high-risk group. Those people, you can have about 1 in 10 who can go on to have long-term mental illness. And then you have the general population. Typically, you see 3 to 5%. So 1 in 20, 1 in 25 people may go on to have long-term mental health consequences of some kind after these events.
And finally, I want to ask you about the perhaps other side of the coin, which is post-traumatic growth, where people are growing in response to a trauma on a personal level. What are we learning about that?
There is no doubt that when people go through difficult events, some of us experience different capacities in ourselves that we did not know we had, and that has been cast as post-traumatic growth. People talk about all of a sudden finding courage and finding resources, finding love that they previously did not know that they had in them. Unfortunately, most of the quantitative literature does not suggest that post-traumatic growth mitigates the adverse mental health consequences of a disaster that we have been talking about, which means that if someone has experienced a traumatic event, someone can just as likely go on to have post-traumatic stress disorder or depression, even while she may experience growth on other personal dimensions.
Sandro, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed talking.
Sandro Galea is Dean of the Boston University School of Public Health. Coming up, when surgery allows you to feel at home in your body.
It's sort of like when you put on clothes that finally fit, you don't notice all the ways that they're uncomfortable and that they're not for you.
Insurance companies are starting to cover gender reassignment procedures, but barriers remain. Still to come on The Pulse.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca strives to offer employees a vibrant, stimulating, and collaborative work environment. AstraZeneca aims to foster a culture that puts patients first, promotes scientific curiosity, values the power of diversity, and ultimately attracts, develops, and retains great people. Learn more about career opportunities with AstraZeneca at astrazeneca.com/careers.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. That's why they're proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches, to help keep you healthy. And it's why they're proud to sponsor programs and events around the city like the Blue Cross Broad Street Run and Indigo, Philadelphia's first bike share program. More at ibx.com and rideindigo.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. President Obama hired the first openly transgender White House staffer this week. This is the latest example of transgender people becoming increasingly visible in mainstream culture. Growing acceptance is bringing about changes in the medical and insurance realm. Health insurance companies are starting to cover gender reassignment surgeries. But challenges to getting procedures done still exist. Carolyn Beal reports.
Andrew DeVita was raised as a girl in the suburbs of Philadelphia, but he started identifying as male at the beginning of college. Though he knew his body didn't match his true gender, he also felt surgery to align the two was out of reach.
Without insurance, I never thought that I was going to be able to afford it.
And the idea of insurance coverage for gender reassignment surgery seemed impossible back then.
It was such a different world, even 5 years ago. There weren't a lot of trans people in the media. They certainly weren't on the front covers of magazines. So to go from that environment to all of a sudden insurance covering these procedures, it was just very, very unthinkable. I, for years, just kind of like resigned myself to binding my chest for 18 hours a day straight.
DeVita started a new job 3 years ago and was surprised to find gender reassignment services were actually covered by his insurance. It wasn't until he had a surgery date on the calendar that it finally sunk in that this was really happening for him.
I was on SEPTA and I started tearing up. It was really embarrassing.
In January, Davina had his breasts removed and his chest reconstructed to look more masculine. He paid about $1,500 out of pocket for a surgery that would have cost him five times that much without insurance. He's now a lot more at ease with his appearance.
I don't feel anxious. I don't feel embarrassed. I don't feel uncomfortable. It's sort of like when you put on clothes that finally fit, you don't notice all the ways that they're uncomfortable. You just go about your life and you don't notice a thing because it's just you.
Chest procedures like Davida's and more expensive genital surgeries have historically not been covered by insurance, but that's slowly changing. Harper Jean Tobin is director of policy at the National Center for Transgender Equality.
It varies a great deal across the country and across different types of insurance, but the overall trend is undoubtedly in the direction away from blanket exclusions and towards covering treatment for gender dysphoria based on individual medical need.
Today, Medicaid programs in six states and Washington, D.C. cover gender reassignment surgeries, hormones, and related health care. 11 states and D.C. require private insurance plans to do the same. And more companies outside of those states are starting to do it voluntarily.
But because of this long history of blanket exclusions in insurance, there still are additional difficulties.
It's sometimes hard for patients to prove that their procedures are medically necessary. That's the standard that must be met for insurance coverage. And many surgeons who specialize in gender reassignment procedures historically haven't taken insurance.
This area of healthcare, treating gender dysphoria, has historically been just cut out of the ordinary system of healthcare and insurance coverage. And eliminating those long-standing but completely arbitrary exclusions turns out to be a very complicated process.
Even as insurers and doctors start ironing out disagreements over reimbursement rates and standards of care, another key barrier remains for transgender people seeking surgery. There simply aren't very many doctors qualified to perform these procedures, and wait lists can be long. Mount Sinai Health System's head of LGBT programs, Dr. Barbara Warren, remembers back in March when New York State's Medicaid program started covering transgender procedures.
And the day the announcement came out, I got a lot of phone calls from many folks who had Medicaid coverage who said to me, oh, at long last, I can get my surgery. Where do I sign up?
But there aren't any surgeons in New York City who perform genital or bottom surgeries.
And so I had to tell people who were very disappointed, you know, we're working on it, we're working on it.
Mount Sinai is recruiting a gender reassignment surgeon, both to do surgeries now and to prepare for what's expected to be an increasing demand in the future.
We want to be able to train the next generation of healthcare providers. So being able to create a fellowship, for example, in this kind of surgery, to be able to train medical students, we really have to begin to make this part of the medical curriculum. And we have to have a program that is sustainable.
Today, there aren't any training programs for transgender surgery, so doctors have to shadow members of the small cadre of practicing surgeons to learn on their own. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
It's impossible to know exactly how many trans people want to have surgery and are having trouble getting the procedure covered or can't find a doctor because there's very little data on any aspect of transgender life. This week, the National Center for Transgender Equality launched the U.S. Trans Survey. It's a very big survey aimed at getting a broad look at the lives of transgender Americans, and we'll link to that on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And joining us now to talk more about the emotional and mental health aspects involved in the issue of gender reassignment surgery are Julia Gottlieb and Jasper Leem. They are both therapists at the Mazzoni Center in Philadelphia. Julia and Jasper, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Our pleasure.
Julia, what are you hearing from people you work with about this waiting for surgery, waiting for perhaps getting approval from the insurance company?
In my time at the Mazzoni Center, I haven't worked with a client who was able to have a procedure done through their insurance company. So a lot of time it's about managing the stress and anxiety that might come from not having the opportunity to have a procedure done that somebody would want. But I also want to add that there's a lot of folks of trans experience out there that are completely fine with not having surgery. So I just want to make sure that there's like not an assumption that for someone to be in true identity, they need to have medical intervention.
Jasper, if people choose to go through with surgery and they have secured a way to pay for it and all of the other things, mm-hmm. there's still a lot of therapy work that has to happen before surgery. What is the kind of route they take?
Sure. Well, one of the things that has been a stumbling block for a lot of people is most surgeons follow what's called the WPATH standards of care, what they used to be called the Harry Benjamin standards of care. And for example, for an FTM trans man, getting a bilateral mastectomy requires one letter from a therapist or doctor or similarly credentialed person to say, yes, this person is stable. Yes, they identify this way. And it's a difficult thing because a lot of people either do identify as a trans man but don't want the surgery, or they don't identify, or they do want the surgery but they don't necessarily identify as a trans man. They don't necessarily identify in that binary way, and so there's a lot of back and forth that has to happen between the therapist and the surgeon to find language that both meets the standards of care and feels true and honest to our clients.
And do some surgeons require people to live in their identity for a certain amount of time before getting the surgery?
I've had, for top surgery, I've had to write letters to say that a person's been living in their authentic gender. But I think as a whole, I know at Mazzoni and other social workers out there, we're trying to move away from the model of having that added barrier for a letter or requiring therapy before a person can make a decision about their body, because I see this as another way to marginalize a population. If you think about it, there are a lot of plastic surgeons out there that, you know, trust that if somebody's coming into their office and they're saying, hey, I have agency over my body, I know what decisions I want to make to medically change my body, like breast augmentation or rhinoplasty, that those surgeons aren't saying we need two letters, we need you to prove that you're actually who you say you are. And that's really coming from a very weak place, not client-centered place at all. So we're of the mentality, we're going to do what we need to do because of the system that's in place right now, but we don't support that gatekeeping system.
So what kind of system would you advocate for?
For people to be able to make choices about their bodies freely.
But what about, I mean, I want to push back a little bit on that, because the surgeon is in a place where they don't know the client very well and they are performing a big life-changing surgery. So doesn't it make sense to ask a few questions before going ahead and doing that?
Yes, I would actually say that one of the things that's very different about getting trans-related surgery, where as opposed to other surgeries that are considered more cosmetic, is that For trans folks, a lot of times it's not realistic to have that 1 year of living in the gender that you identify as. So, for example, that in plenty of states, you know, it's great that, you know, SCOTUS has passed, you know, gay marriage, for example. But in plenty of states, Virginia, for example, you can still get fired for being trans. Or you can still get fired for being gay. And so even though that we do see a lot of progress in areas, that doesn't necessarily mean that we're safe to follow those protocols.
So, Julia, you would see the surgeon having conversations and then trusting that the client has thought this through?
I'm a firm believer that a person is their own best expert. And the less bureaucratic barriers that get in the way of somebody doing what they want to do with their body is what I am for. If there's an extreme situation where somebody is obviously seeming unstable or there's red alarms going off, the same way that any doctor would, you know, need to step in if that was the case, I get that. But to make a across the board ruling based on a surgeon's fear, I think that's very problematic.
Jasper and Julia, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Julia Gottlieb and Jasper Leem are therapists with the Mazzoni Center in Philadelphia. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and we're going to turn now to the machine that is creating our future to some extent. All right, so nobody is printing out kidneys just yet, but there's still a lot of stuff to be excited about with 3D printers, especially in medicine. For example, the devices can create form-fitting hearing aids and dental implants. Earlier this summer, the FDA approved the first printed prescription pills. And now a Philadelphia startup called BioBots is trying to push the field even further by printing out living tissues. Todd Bookman reports.
The laboratory of the future looks a lot like the laboratories of the past. Beakers and white coats and dark countertops, everything neat and well-labeled.
We just moved in here about a month ago, so you can see it's still sort of getting set up.
Danny Cabrera is walking around BioBots' new headquarters in West Philadelphia. He's the co-founder, and his product is a new type of 3D printer. The old type typically uses plastic as its raw ingredient. A spool gets fed into the machine and either melted or blasted with UV radiation as it's formed into the shape you tell it to print out, a bracelet, a guitar, whatever. But if you want to create something living, something made from actual cells, animal or human, that method won't cut it.
You definitely cannot use heat with living cells. You would burn and fry everything. You also can't use UV radiation because when you like walk out into the sun, that's where you go and you put on sunscreen because you don't want to harm your cells, the DNA in your cells. So neither of those two processes really works well with cells.
Cabrera's 3D printer gets around the problem by using beams of light to harden the material.
And now the device has a series of LED lights that are in the visible spectrum, so they're not UV. But they are, they're just LED lights that concentrate light. And as soon as the material comes out of the nozzle, comes out of that tip of the syringe, lights shine on it and it turns it from a liquid to a solid.
The machine still looks like other desktop 3D printers. It's shaped like a cube, maybe a foot or so high, with the nozzle moving around in the box. Air pressure pushes the materials, which resemble cupcake frosting, out of the opening. But the goo, the frosting, isn't just cells alone. It's a substance called bio-ink. The technical term is extracellular matrix. It's like scaffolding for living cells to hang out and build on. Each bio-ink needs to be specially designed for the type of cells you want to have living inside of it. A liver cell thrives in a different environment than skin or brain cells. Tim Olson is leading this area of research for BioBots. He says, think of the ink as a ready-made mix.
At the end of the day, that's what we're really shooting for, to get like a basic master mix. So if you want to be able to make a cartilage, we're going to give you this ink here. And it has everything you need. You just add water, or add your cell culture media, add your cells, and put it into the printer, and it prints. That's the goal. We're working towards it.
Just add a few living cells to the bio ink, print it out of the BioBot, give it a little time, and grow new cartilage or a kidney. A working organ is a long ways off, but if scientists can produce even a millimeter thick layer of an organ, that could be used in, say, early stage pharmaceutical tests. At Drexel University, Professor Kara Spiller is using her BioBot to study how human bones regenerate after a break. She uses cells and inks to print out the intricate structure that makes up our bones.
I guess it would be more accurate to say that we're not printing bone, but we're rather printing precursors to bone.
At a previous laboratory, Spiller had the chance to do some 3D bioprinting on a unit that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars and took up an entire room. She says the BioBot at $5,000 performs just as well.
No one has ever been able to buy a printer before. It was just too expensive. So anybody who had an idea about 3D printing in the bio realm, we couldn't do it. So now anyone can do it.
BioBots only released 50 machines during its initial launch. It spent the past year collecting feedback from researchers like Spiller. And next month, the company plans to unveil a second version with some improved features. And because the machines can't print money, BioBots is also busy raising funds from venture capitalists. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
Coming up...
You're as cold as ice. You're willing to sacrifice our love.
We've heard a lot about cold offices, AC units, and new research on human physiology that seems to explain why men and women always argue about the right temperature. We'll hear another take on why the perfect temperature is so elusive. Still to come on The Pulse.
Supporting WHYY is The Pulse. AstraZeneca strives to create a culture where employees are excited by their work, have a clear sense of purpose, and display confidence in their ability to meet challenges and seize opportunities. More at AstraZeneca.com/careers.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. They are proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches. IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. Pretty much as soon as children are born, they start seeing a pediatrician. And when they get a little bit older, old enough to remember all those needles that are directed at them in that office, they usually leave with a prize of sorts. Stickers, perhaps. Yes, they have Elsa and Anna stickers. Or maybe a cheap little toy. But there's one thing that's become a no-no among giveaways, and maybe it deserves a second look. Tanya English reports.
Look, I have to hold this.
3-year-old Jaden is at the doctor's office for his checkup before preschool begins in September. He might leave with a Ninja Turtle sticker today, but he's definitely not getting a lollipop. Mom Sabrina Statham says when it's time for a shot, she holds Jaden in her lap while someone from the doctor's office distracts him.
Hey, Jay. He cries, yeah, but I don't think it's like a lot. It's like he'll get the needle and then, what, like a couple seconds later, it's all good.
Our medical assistants have all been trained in special comfort measures, like rubbing the muscle before they give the vaccine. We'll have them hold their breath and count to 10. We can even have them blow bubbles.
Pediatrician Katie McPeak runs the Center for the Urban Child at St. Christopher's Hospital for Children in North Philadelphia. First off, she says lollipops are a choking hazard.
Totally. And dum-dums are the worst because the head of the lollipop is so small, it could actually fit into a child's airway.
Plus, suckers create a sticky mix of acid, bacteria, and sugar in the mouth.
When you're licking that lollipop, you're presenting that sugar right to the child's tooth. So giving a lollipop would be completely contradictory to our mission of preventing cavities.
Many hospitals use a few drops of sugar water to calm an infant who's having a painful injection or circumcision. But for routine needle sticks at the pediatrician's office, McPeak says there's no need.
The circumcision takes about 3 to 5 minutes. Our vaccines take seconds. We like to reward kids with hugs and praise and good job, not necessarily something that they're taking with them.
California pediatrician Wolf Nadulman says rewarding kids with candy is basically a bad idea.
And I discourage parents from doing that.
And yet, at his practice in Berkeley, there's a basket filled with lollipops.
I don't do things always the way my peers do.
Nadulman says lollipops can be a tool for good medicine. He uses them sparingly, especially with very young children.
None of us wants shots. Nobody likes getting shots. There's a shock-like reaction that happens physiologically in the child when they have such enormous anxiety. It's not good enough to say to the child, yes, but this will keep you healthy when you're 15.
Instead, he asks kids to think about what lollipop they'll get after the needle stick. He says pick a color and imagine the flavor. Sugar isn't a pain reliever, but we're hardwired to love it. And Adulman says sugar can change brain chemistry almost as soon as it touches the tongue.
Sweet sugar candy man.
And these good-feeling receptors send a message to the brain that things are good. We're eating something yummy.
How the doctor uses a lollipop depends on a child's age and developmental stage. For example, older kids usually aren't that anxious about getting their vaccines. But for them, a lollipop might make a bitter medicine taste better.
Nah, I just like lollipops. No, it doesn't fix anything. The root beer one.
Some parents worry about too many sweets. But Nadulman says studies show that sugar doesn't cause chronic hyperactivity or other behavior problems. At his office, children get dum-dums because that brand has lots of kid-friendly flavors, including cotton candy and bubble gum.
and they're small. Did I say they were small? They're small.
Just 25 calories. It's a pretty cheap way to buy a little calm and goodwill at the pediatrician's office. And of course, in the end, mom or dad has the final say. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English. Mama told me what I should know.
Which candy gonna rot your soul? When we age out of lollipops, what a lot of us really want from our physicians is care. Care that goes beyond managing illness or symptoms, a relationship. Maureen O'Brien, a nurse who lives in Haddon Heights, New Jersey, found that kind of relationship during a really difficult time in her life. In 2000, she was diagnosed with MS. Shortly after, she had her first appointment with Thomas Leist. He runs the Comprehensive Multiple Sclerosis Center at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital in Philadelphia. For our series, Patient Files, they sat down together to talk about Maureen's care and how they've learned to negotiate as a team.
The weird thing is I thought I had just like a sciatic problem, and I had gotten a new corner. I thought it was just hitting me wrong, and I had tripped and fallen. And then I was having trouble brushing my hair. And then I had a really bad fall. I like fell like off of one step, and I just kept on going. I couldn't stop myself. When I finally went to my physician, he thought it was worth it for me to go and get checked since I was having so much pain. I had multiple sclerosis, and I can tell you I was completely shocked. Threw me through a loop. That was the last thing I thought I had. My husband got Dr. Leist's name. He had just came to Jefferson, and I got an appointment with him. And right away he sat down and he talked to me. And he kind of talked to me as a person, not as a disease. And I think one of the first thing he ever said to me, and I'll never forget this, he said, you know, MS is always going to be in your living room. It just shouldn't be in the center of your living room.
I do think that multiple sclerosis affects the whole organism of a person, even though it's a neurological disease. And it also affects the organism of the family, of the care network of a person that is surrounding an individual. And so it is in this context that I think one has to discuss the disease.
Mm-hmm. At first, I wasn't really sure, and I had such weakness. And I was trying – I have a second floor, and, you know, trying to negotiate for a while. I was having problems even getting up and down the steps and things like that. And, you know, some days I was really bad. I would go up on my butt, and I would just be pissed. And I just thought, this is not going to happen. I'm not letting this happen. I have to do something to kind of get better. I was exhausted, and I just thought, this is crazy. I mean, is this what it feels like? You know, because for me, there's thought for me to walk, where I'm going, how many steps. So if I do too much, or if I'm working and I'm not sitting and taking a break, I almost like want to cry because I'm so exhausted, and my legs hurt so bad, and my back hurts. So it's negotiation and kind of listening to my body, and I think that's what Dr. Leist kind of taught me, like, listen to your body.
There is a certain reservoir of energy for the day, but at some point in time, it really becomes more difficult, mm-hmm. certainly towards the end of the day, and so things are probably best done in the morning. Mm-hmm. Through all of this, she continued to work as a nurse manager, and somewhere along the path, we also had to discuss how do you take advantage mm-hmm. of your family members, of your loved ones, of your care network to help you out and to kind of complement you in areas where perhaps you have to step back a little bit. And that's sometimes not so easy for somebody to let go.
Especially not me. That's really hard for me because I think that's it's innate as a nurse is to take care of somebody else, and to have somebody else take care of you was really difficult. I sometimes push the envelope and don't want to do it. And he negotiates with me, but I have a voice in my care, which is really important. It's not just like, take this, here's this, and go. It's a conversation. If I say, if I had to get steroids IV, which I did for a while, I said, no, I don't think I need them. He goes, yeah, okay. So I'm going to order them. And we laugh about that because we have that kind of relationship. Like, I know I have to have them.
MS is a disease that sometimes doesn't want to negotiate. It kind of tells the patient, this is what I'm going to do. I'll sometimes tell individuals that MS can be a very stubborn negotiator. And so there needs to be a place for negotiation. Yes, we have a conversation around it. And I mean, in the current healthcare environment, to be able to take the time and have a conversation has become a luxury. But I do think if we have conversations, we may actually reduce healthcare cost overall. We increase adherence to treatments that are initiated. There may be a buy-in to what we do.
Being a nurse and being in healthcare, I mean, you don't see it that often. I was shocked. You know, you don't see that. I'm in practice. You don't see that often. And it was a breath of fresh air, and I think that's why it makes you want to do well and continue to be, you know, to take care of yourself so because of your physician.
Maureen O'Brien is a New Jersey nurse who sees neurologist Thomas Leist for treatment of multiple sclerosis at Jefferson University Hospital in Philadelphia. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Women are cold in the office because the AC temperatures are set for men who tend to run a bit warmer. That's what we've been hearing about the age-old temperature fight. Regular Pulse contributor Bethany Brookshire has some new insight to add to this debate. She is a writer for Science News and Society for Science and the Public. Hi, Bethany.
Hey, nice to be here.
Give us a quick summary of what we've been hearing about men, women, and the AC settings.
Mostly what we've been hearing is a lot of anecdotes about how women are freezing in the office. But we've also been hearing there's a new study out in Nature Climate Change saying that the reason that women are cold in the office is because the metabolic standards taken into account for air conditioning are designed with men in mind. And while this study does show that, that's not actually why you're cold.
So why are we cold?
We're cold because whoever's setting the thermostat is terrible. That's why.
So we're cold because it's too cold?
We're cold because it's cold. So the study is very interesting. It notes that when people design heating and cooling systems for buildings, they take into account things like subjective temperatures at which people feel comfortable, and they also include a measure of metabolic rate. And the measure of metabolic rate is based on that of a 40-year-old man who weighs about 70 kilograms, or about 154 pounds. Now, if that man seems a little weedy, and he should, that's because he's an average. He's an average of metabolic rates for a lot of different people. And that metabolic rate is taken into account when designing the heating and cooling systems. So this article points out that actually, according to their study, women have a lower resting metabolic rate, and there should be more than one data point taken into account, more than one average, when computing differences between men and women and when designing buildings. And the goal would be to use a large variety of numbers to design buildings more efficiently. But the way a building is designed has nothing to do with who sets the thermostat.
When we say how buildings are designed, what do we even mean by that?
In this case, what we're talking about is the heating and cooling systems. So when people design heating and cooling systems, they design them to function the most efficiently at specific temperatures. You want it to function very efficiently at around 70 to 75 or 78 degrees because that's where people are comfortable. And so they design buildings based on this big, long, complicated equation that includes metabolic rate and subjective feelings of comfort. But again, that's how the building's designed. When you turn it over, you design the building, you build the building, and you turn it over to operations, that's when it all goes downhill.
So all our knowledge about metabolic rates and all that, you're saying it doesn't even come into play when you go to the office because it was Fred from office services who pushed the button.
That is exactly right. Yes.
All right. But about the metabolic rates, that part you agree with, that women have different obvious metabolic rates and maybe are cold more easily. Is that part true?
Yes. According to this study, yes. But it's also important to note that even if more metabolic rates were taken into account, some of the scientists I spoke to actually said it wouldn't make that much of a difference because the big numbers that are taken into account was a huge study of 1,300 men and women all wearing exactly the same clothing and all performing exactly the same tasks. And they got asked, as the temperature fluctuated up and down, whether they were comfortable. Those subjective ratings, whether you're comfortable at a particular temperature, that's the main metric that goes into building design. The metabolic rate is in there, but it's not as important a factor. So even if you did factor in a bunch more numbers, as the study suggests, it may not actually really change the metrics on how buildings are designed. It might change them a little, but it probably wouldn't change them very much.
And I'm wondering also if you can even find the perfect temperature, because I think among women, there are big differences in terms of what they are comfortable with, depending on their age and maybe depending how much muscle tissue they have. Who knows?
Yes, that's a very good point. And that's actually something that a couple of the scientists I spoke to mentioned. The variations between individuals are actually much larger than any variation between the sexes. So really, designing a thermostat set just for women probably wouldn't keep any more women comfortable than are currently comfortable.
Thank you so much, Bethany.
Thank you.
Bethany Brookshire of Science News. She writes for the educational blog Eureka Lab. And that's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson is the managing editor. Megan Pinto, the executive producer. Chris Cetullo is vice president of news. Did you miss some of this show or any of our previous shows? Subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes or on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And that's also where you can get in touch with us. Send us an email. Do you have any questions about stuff we've covered? Any ideas for future reports? We always love to hear from you. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
And my mama cried. And my mama cried. Save your money, don't go to the show.